Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. The G8 meeting is coming to a close, but world leaders failed to come to an agreement on several key issues, including setting specific short-term targets for carbon emission limits. After a week of relative calm, demonstrations in Iran again took to the streets, and China's president promised harsh punishment for those who played a role in recent violence there. Joining me to discuss these and other top international stories, Andrei Sitov, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for Itar Tass, Farah Stockman, Foreign Affairs Reporter with the Boston Globe, and Tom Jelton, familiar voice to many of you, correspondent for National Public Radio. Welcome. Nice to have you all here.
Nice to see you, Steve.
1-800-433-8850 is our phone number, drshow@wamu.org, our email address, and please join us in this conversation for the next hour. Tom, in Moscow, a lot of talk about an agreement to talk about reducing nuclear weapons between Russia and the United States. What came out of this meeting?
Well, from the view of the Obama administration, quite a bit, actually. The White House is saying it was one of the most substantive meetings that a U.S. president has had with Russian leaders in a long time. There was this agreement to reduce the strategic arsenal on both sides. In addition, a very important agreement on the Russians agreed to allow the United States to use Russian territory to access Afghanistan. And this has been a big concern, of course, with the big buildup, U.S. military buildup in Afghanistan. It's very important we have access routes there. The Russians agreed to allow Russian territory to be used for that. And there was, I think, also just a sort of a what the Russians call they stop the degradation of relations. Just the fact of Obama being there and sort of defusing a little bit the tensions that had developed in recent months between the Russian and U.S. governments.
Andrei, how did this meeting look from the Russian point of view? What was the commentary in the Russian news organizations and general reaction?
I think the important thing here is that the meeting happened, that it happened so soon in the new administration. And, of course, it didn't hurt that the new administration actually wanted to reset the relationship from the bad point where it was under the previous one. I would say that from my perspective, the most important decision taken at the summit was this new intergovernmental commission that we are supposed to have. It will be formally chaired by both presidents, which is an upgrade from what we used to have. I've been observing.
What would it do?
I've been observing the bureaucracies for a very long time, mostly the American bureaucracy and the Russian and previously the Soviet bureaucracies. They are actually pretty similar, more similar than I expected when I started this. And I know from that experience that the bureaucrats do not do anything unless they have to. And in this case, we are looking forward to seeing whether the presidents can actually make them do things, the really practical things. The Americans here are focused on rather narrowly on the one or two objectives that were important to them, which is Iran, Afghanistan, as mentioned, and probably to a lesser degree, I wouldn't say, of course, it's not right to say to a lesser degree, but the nuclear arms control also was very important. This is all fine. We are for doing that. We do want to be partners, but if we talk about partnership, we want to see deeds rather than words.
Let me ask you this. All summitry involves personalities as well. Mm-hmm. I was a correspondent in 1988, accompanied Ronald Reagan to Moscow for the visit with Mikhail Gorbachev. And the personal relationship between Reagan, who called Russia the evil empire, and Gorbachev was important in terms of a level of trust and communication. Give us a sense of the relationship that Obama seemed to be establishing both with his counterpart, President Medvedev, as well as Prime Minister Putin.
My feeling is that every new team that comes in begins the same way. They say, our predecessors wanted this personal chemistry. We don't want this. We want to proceed from our national interest. And then they will invariably go back to the personal chemistry anyway. So it is important. And from every account that I have seen, and I was not there to observe it myself, but from every account that I have seen, it did work, especially with the younger guys, with the two presidents of our two countries. They're both lawyers. They both talk the same talk. We'll see if they walk the same walk.
Farah Stockman, give us your sense of what the significance of this meeting was.
Well, I think that the Bush administration took a different approach, where they would just basically do what they wanted in the world and try to convince Russia that it was in Russia's interest to let it happen. And I see a lot more horse trading going on between Obama and Putin. Obama says, well, maybe we could change our mind on the missile defense if you help us get rid of the need for the missile defense, which is Iran's nuclear program. Maybe you can give us back some bases in Kyrgyzstan and access to Afghanistan, and somehow we'll say that Ukraine and Georgia don't meet the criteria for NATO membership. It seems like Obama is much more willing to trade back and forth with Russia, which I think is. Maybe it's not where we should be. Maybe it's not the alliance that we want, but it's in the right direction.
Tom, do you agree? Did you see a difference in the atmospherics of the tone of the approach of the Obama administration, both on the personal level that Andre was talking about and the policy level that Farah was talking about?
Yes, but I think one of the things that's interesting is it seems like the Russian leadership is trying to limit the effect of Obama's charm. And his charisma and his personality. I mean, he got a much more cool reception in Moscow than he has in other capitals. And even the speech he gave at the New Economic School, which was a very eloquent speech, and he spoke to Russian values. He spoke to the Russian role in World War II. He addressed his remarks to the Russian youth. The audience was very limited. It was not carried on Russian television. So I think that there was, I don't know whether it was a fear on the part of the Russian leadership that he may be would be too charming to the Russian people, but there seems to have been an effort to limit his influence there.
Was there, Andrei?
A small correction. The speech was carried, it was a big deal, and the speech was carried on the main Russian cable channel, and also on the Russia Today, which is the English language channel. But many people watch it, especially in larger cities.
But it did seem mm-hmm. particularly contrasted to some of the euphoric crowds Obama and greeted in Berlin and other places, that there's a lot of stories on American TV mm-hmm. of Muscovites being largely uninterested in his visit.
Personally, I give the president a lot of benefit of the doubt at this point, not because he is the president of the United States, but because he is the author of a very good book, Dreams from My Father. Unfortunately, I don't think that very many people in Russia have read it, even though it is available in Russian. But I'm not surprised at the atmosphere that people describe, and that I have seen similar descriptions before. I'm not surprised because we have seen very many leaders approaching us with very many different attitudes. I remember the backslapping days of Bill Clinton, where we were supposed to be quote-unquote good friends, but the Americans did what they wanted with us anyway. Many Russians believe that the Americans took advantage of our country after the end of the Cold War. To overcome that mistrust and suspicion, it will take some effort. And again, deeds speak louder than words. And if the new Commerce Secretary in this administration begins his job in Moscow, and he was the only cabinet mm-hmm. levels attendant at the meeting. And if he begins his work by saying, you know what, yeah, we probably will repeal that Jackson-Vanik amendment, but the Russians need to do some things beforehand. That is so tired. That is so. It's just a big disappointment.
Well, the Jackson-Vanik amendment, we should point out, is a long-standing Cold War
relic
on the. On immigration. Farah, let's move on to the G8 meeting, which succeeded the Russian trip in Italy. And there, a lot of discussion about climate change. And really, it would seem that the story was more disagreement than agreement. Update us on this.
Well, I mean, I don't take the same tact. I think there was some agreement. Developed countries did agree to cut emissions by 80% by 2050. Developing nations agreed to set some kind of goal by the Copenhagen meeting.
In December, the Copenhagen meeting.
Right. And I think that I think the big picture here is that we now have a U.S. president who's saying, look, this is the defining challenge of our time. The science cannot be ignored, and we need to move forward. We in the U.S. Are passing legislation. We're doing significant things. You better get on board. And I don't think that it got as far as people wanted. Right after the developed nations agreed to their emissions cut, Canada said, well, it's aspirational. Russia said, well, we're never going to meet that target. But I do think there's a success. There is some success here.
But there seems to be the two countries that are the targets of a lot of concern, huge consumers of energy, developing countries, China and India, really seem to be dragging their feet on any agreement.
Yeah, and I think that's always been a problem. I think that was the problem also with Kyoto. But under the last administration, when India and China decided not to get on board, that was the excuse for the U.S. to say, well, we're not signing up either. And now it's no longer an excuse. Now you're seeing the U.S. lead and push forward.
Tom, quickly, leading up to the meeting, a considerable disagreement between the United States and European allies on the question of stimulus versus inflation. How did that play out?
Well, it didn't play out very well, Steve. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, was saying it's time to start thinking about exit strategies from the stimulus program. And Gordon Brown and Sarkozy of France both said, whoa, we still have a long ways to go. In the end, they decided to just let each country chart its own path. But, you know, what's the G8 for? To cooperate. There wasn't much cooperation.
Tom Gelton of NPR, and I'll be back with my guests in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest on this hour of the Friday News Roundup, Andrei Sitov, the Washington bureau chief for Itar Tass, Farah Stockman, foreign affairs reporter with the Boston Globe, Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. Sorry to cut you off there, Tom, just before the end of the break. But today, sort of the last leg of his foreign trip, President Obama has been meeting with the Pope, the Holy Father has sort of gone out of his way to be friendly to this new president, even though they have significant disagreements on issues like abortion, stem cell research. They do seem to have areas of agreement on issues like control of nuclear weapons, economic justice. Talk about that relationship.
Well, Steve, that's right. I mean, Pope Benedict has a reputation of being a very conservative pope, but just this week with the G8 summit in Italy, he came out with this encyclical that basically was critical of capitalism in ways that were sort of reminiscent of the things that John Paul II said. I think that once these cardinals are elevated to the position of pope, they sort of take on a little bit more of a broader worldview. I'm sure that President Obama appreciated this audience. You're right. They do have ideological differences, or they would seem to. You remember when President Obama spoke at the commencement at Notre Dame, there were a lot of Catholics in this country that protested that and didn't think he even should be invited to speak at Notre Dame. So it certainly helps Obama that the that the Pope gave him this audience today. I'm sure it was very welcome. It's also sort of de rigueur for an American president on his first trip to Italy to have an audience with the Pope.
And it also seems a part of the itinerary of American presidents to visit Africa briefly. On his way home, president stopping in Ghana, an African country that a lot of people say is a showcase for democratic value.
That's right, Steve. He went to Ghana. He did not go to Kenya. And he is half Kenyan, remember. So I think that's very significant. And I think that what that shows is that the United States doesn't intend for this to be purely symbolic. There are some real serious issues in Kenya right now with corruption, with governance, with sectarian strife. And instead of going to Kenya, the administration has chosen to go to Ghana, which is, as you say, a real showcase of, for the moment, of you know, strong economic principles and good governance.
Now, Farah, you've recently been traveling as well to Afghanistan, and a lot of news coming out of Afghanistan, the expansion of American mission to Helmand Province to try to control the Taliban activity there, a step up in violence in the last couple of days, some major incidents. Give us an update.
Well, I have to say that I've been to Afghanistan three times, and every time I go back, it's a little bit worse. Right outside the capital of Kabul, even half an hour's drive, it's dangerous to go. People fear kidnappers. The U.S. military takes helicopters just to go a very short distance. So I think the situation there was much more dire than I expected. I don't think anybody disputes the fact that the U.S. military can defeat the Taliban in an all-out battle in Helmand Province or anywhere else. I mean, I think even the Taliban would agree with that, and that's why they're fleeing. The question is just what's going to happen after the battle is over. How do you pacify that country? How do you bring governance to these areas without the Taliban just waiting us out and coming back?
Well, when you say fleeing, there's a long history of American involvement in Asia and guerrilla warfare, and what the Taliban seems to be doing is what the Viet Cong did before them, is melt into the population and avoid direct confrontation.
Sure, and there's a lot of tactics from Iraq that you're seeing be brought to Afghanistan, the IEDs, the suicide bombs. I mean, that wasn't there when I was there in 2005, and it's now such a big part of the way that fighting is being done. The U.S. military is starting a new program in a place called Wardak Province, which is actually what I think they're putting a lot of stock in, where they're trying to train local men to protect their own villages from the Taliban. And there's a lot of criticism of this, arming locals. But I think they're hoping that this is going to turn the situation around.
And Andre, there is some talk that this escalation in violence is aimed at the elections on August 20th. Perhaps to sabotage the elections. Do you have any, of course, Russia has a long history of involvement in Afghanistan, too. You got a sense of whether this violence is aimed at the elections?
It probably is. People everywhere try to use the elections as a rallying point. Look at Iran. Mm-hmm. Look at what just happened in some of the former Soviet states. I guess from the Russian perspective, when we look at the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq, a couple major points I want to make. First, no one, at least no one I'm aware of among major Russian politicians and political forces, wishes for the Americans to suffer a quote-unquote loss in either country. The Russians are trying to help, as you just said. You mentioned this military transit agreement. Mm-hmm. Where, aside from everything else, a major sticking point had been the question of payments for the flights. And the Russians agreed to waive the navigation fees, which amount to millions in this case. So the Russians are trying to help. At the same time, the Russians want the Americans to be in Afghanistan, because for us, the biggest threat coming out of that country is drugs. The flow of drugs that inundate our country and the neighboring states. And it's a huge, given our health problems, it's a huge situation for us to deal with. So basically, we want to be partners with you But we also warn you, and the Russian government warned the Americans about Iraq even before the war started, that, guys, you need to watch out, you need to know what you're doing, and you need to have an exit strategy.
A number of other countries we want to talk about quickly, Tom, but before we move to the Middle East, in China, the president of China left precipitously the G8 meeting and didn't even participate, President Hu, because of the unrest in the western provinces, the Uyghur minority, a Muslim a people. Been demonstrations, violent demonstrations, 150 dead. Obviously, the departure of the Chinese president signaled how seriously they took this. What's the update?
Because this was a really important summit for the Chinese, yeah, and you're right, for Hu to go all the way to Rome and turn around and go right back. They were very concerned about the situation, particularly in Xinjiang province, where all these riots took place. What's behind this is there's been a lot of, you know, one of the stories we don't hear about in China much is how much internal migration there has been. Migrant workers are a huge factor in China. And this is one of the provinces where there has been a lot of internal migration. And there is a longstanding ethnic there's longstanding animosity between the Uyghur population and the majority Han population, Chinese population there. And a big influx of Han Chinese into this province over the last few years, and sort of in the context of the economic crisis and higher unemployment and social problems, it was inevitable that there would be some tension there, and it really erupted. The Chinese responded with a very heavy hand. This is traditionally the way they deal with unrest. But I think there's no question that the Chinese have the capability to put this down. However, it does raise some serious issues. The Uyghurs are a Turkic people, and Turkey is one of the countries that has been very important in terms of China's relationship with the West. And the Turkish government Turkey is very concerned about this right now. So there are some geopolitical ramifications apart from the internal unrest issues that the Chinese leadership has to deal with here.
Well, their language is Turkic, but they're also Muslim. And in terms of China's relationship with the Muslim world, this is not a happy incident.
No, and one of the places where we're going to see this have some reverberations is in Iran. Iran has already spoken out. The government of Iran has spoken out about with great concern about the effects of this on the crackdown on a Muslim population in China.
Farah, let's turn to Iran. We had a situation where the news from Iran after the election dominated the news for a couple of weeks. Major demonstrations. The government of Tehran, like the government of Beijing, responded by cracking down, limiting access of reporters, trying to control both the situation in the streets and what the world knew. And it seemed to be dying out. And then now there seems to be a resurgence of protest in the streets of Tehran. What do we know?
I think thousands of people came out. That's according to the reports. We are seeing mass demonstrations, but today that took place on Thursday. But in addition to that, I think there are quieter demonstrations happening in neighborhoods all around Tehran that we're not really hearing about. There's another form of protest where people are writing in green pen on all the money. They're writing Mousavi's name. And their hope is that all the money in circulation will have his name. So I think you're starting to see different ways that this protest can bubble up, and I don't see it going away.
I wanted to jump in here and to say that when I look at all these things that are happening, all of them that we've discussed, relations between Russia and the United States, the G8 and the role of the G8 in this new world, the economic crisis, Iran, China, all of that is in a way for me, and that's just my perspective, the world after the Cold War. We have not yet come to grips with it, I think. These are the most important questions that I keep asking American politicians when I have a chance. For instance, whether they believe that the demise of the Soviet Union and the current difficulties of the other superpower, the United States, are historically connected. Most people say no, but they cannot give me arguments that I find convincing. I feel they are connected, all these things. And the biggest lesson of this transition period in the world history for me is that there is no monopoly on the truth. The Soviets pretended we knew what was best not only for us but for others. We crashed. The Americans believe they know what's best not only for the Americans but for all the world. America is crashing with that idea. Barack Obama is a repudiation, a living repudiation of that idea promoted by the previous administration.
Tom, to tie some of these under who's saying, a lot of these stories tie together. We were talking earlier about the Russian and American attempt to control nuclear weapons. And when you talk about Iran, not only is this a major issue, as Andre was saying earlier, between the United States and Russia and their common interest in controlling Iran's nuclear ambitions, but President Obama continued to say, even after the protests, that in the end, Washington's interests with Tehran first and foremost involved trying to negotiate an end to their nuclear ambitions.
That's right. And the big debate going on right now, Steve, is whether Obama's idea of engagement has been vindicated or repudiated as a result of the events in Iran. And there's sort of arguments to be made on both sides. One of the things that we have seen as a result of the disputed election and the protests that followed it is there has been sort of a hardening of the European position vis-a-vis Iran. And this had been, under the Bush administration, there were some clear splits between the position that the United States took and the position a lot of European countries took in terms of how hard a line the international community should adopt with respect to Iran's nuclear program. I think we have seen a sort of a coming together, and particularly in the context of, with Russia and everything else, I think there is right now a moment when there is going to be more international unity in terms of putting pressure on the Iranian regime to come clean with its nuclear program.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. We have a couple of lines open. We're going to turn to our callers in just a minute. But, Farah, I want to deal with one other very important development and actually several developments in Iraq, including the more aggressive assertion of territorial integrity and separateness on the part of the Kurds in northern Iraq. This is not a new story in some ways, that it's been a semi-autonomous region for a long time, but some new developments.
Yeah, I think the Kurds are starting to get frustrated with Baghdad. A lot of the disagreements that have been simmering for years over oil, over the share of oil they should get, over whether the state-controlled oil company should make decisions, or whether we should have production sharing agreements, and the Kurds are and disputed territories, and these questions have been left unresolved for a long time, and the Kurds are impatient, and they're saying we need to move forward and resolve some of these. Whereas I think Maliki's government doesn't appreciate those moves by the Kurds. And he's also starting to become an Arab, an Arab nationalist, which is, I think, worrisome for the Kurds. Maliki is starting to position himself politically as an Arab nationalist against the Kurds. And I think this is worrisome because the Sunnis were always an odd man out. It was always the Kurds were the voice of reason, and they were the ones who were arguing for the greater good of Iraq. And even though they wanted their own semi-autonomous area, they were still speaking of things in terms of unity with the government. And now we're seeing a shift. We're seeing the Shias and the Kurds draw farther apart. I think that's worrisome.
And of course, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, was the author, co-author of a plan at one time that would provide for what was sometimes called a soft partition of Iraq.
Well, right. Some people would say that Biden's plan was simply what was already enshrined in the Iraqi Constitution. It depends on your interpretation of that document, I guess. I think the Obama administration had hoped to turn its attention to Afghanistan, get away from Iraq, and last week they asked Biden to look more closely at Iraq. I think that's a sign that they see Iraq is continuing to be worrisome, and that they can't just shut it out.
And in addition, Tom, to the problem of the Kurds, there's the problem of ongoing violence.
That's what I was going to say. It's not just the Kurds. Kurds. What we're seeing is real sectarian strife returning in Iraq. A lot of violence this week, most of it directed against Shiites, and it's coming just as the United States has pulled its troops out of major cities. The big question in Iraq is whether the Iraqi security forces are going to be capable of handling security responsibilities in Iraq. Right now, with these rising ethnic tensions, whether it's the Kurds in the north or tensions between the Sunni and the Shiite, populations, I think there are some real concerns.
I also think that there's a real danger here for Obama in that we could get stuck with one foot in Iraq and one foot in Afghanistan and not really have the freedom of movement to do any of those two very complicated countries justice.
Is there any sense that given the pullback of American troops and the rise in violence, that there's any rethinking about the strategy, Tom, or is the Americans completely devoted to this pullback, whatever instability results?
Well, I think, Steve, one point to keep in mind is that there's less to this pullback than you might think. The Obama administration makes a big issue of there not being, after a certain point, combat troops in Iraq. But what we've seen with the nature of warfare in Iraq is basically everybody who's in Iraq is under the category of combat troops. And the numbers that we're seeing now, we're down to 130,000. But that's only the number that was there before the surge. And we're going to see 130,000 or 120,000 throughout the rest of this year. So there's not a major pullback here.
I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and we're going to get to your calls as soon as we come back from this break. So stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Drew Barrymore. The HBO film Grey Gardens, which she starred in, comes out on DVD next week. Also, David Edelstein reviews Sacha Baron Cohen's new movie, Bruno. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, and I'm sitting in today for Diane. And in this hour, our foreign news hour of the news Friday News Roundup, Andrei Sitov is with me. He's the Washington bureau chief of Itar Tass, Farah Stockman from the Boston Globe, Tom Jelton from National Public Radio. And let's turn to some of our callers. And Charlene in McLean, Virginia, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Nice to have
Thank
you. What's
you.
On your mind?
Yeah. I just want to make some comment on about these two hosts. One is this Russian guy. I think most Americans.
<That's you. laughs>
Yeah, I think most Americans should listen to him. I think agree with him 100%. You know, the other American guy comment about China, about the Uyghur problem. you know, I don't know why he can't think of things coherently if he doesn't know very much about China and the Uyghur. You know, nobody come to the United States, Thai Indians, they're not American. They don't speak English. They should be independent, okay? And also, he's talking about the Chinese government heavy-handed, you know, just sending troops there to try to, you know, calm things down, to, you know, make their own country peaceful. And American sending troops and missiles to Iraq, Baghdad, okay. Saying that's not heavy-handed.
Thank you very much for your comment. Tom, do you have any response?
You know, I was trying to figure out from what Charlene was saying what, you know, what her perspective is. I guess that she sympathizes with the Chinese government's response to the unrest there. If she's disputing whether it's fair to characterize it as heavy-handed, I mean, we've just seen the Chinese leadership now proposing that the rioters be executed. I mean, that seems to me that's a pretty heavy-handed response.
Farah, and also one of the interesting connections between the Chinese response and in Iran, both went after journalists, both went after news organizations, both aware that the internet and cell phones and text messaging make it harder for totalitarian governments to keep out or keep news down. And this is an interesting dimension we're seeing in both places.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still a lot that we don't know about what happened in China. I think, unlike in Iran, the Chinese Uyghurs did not have Twitter accounts and they were not posting as many pictures. I think it's difficult to find out. The Chinese government says 156 people have died, but Uyghur protesters say the number is far higher and that 90% of the victims were Uyghur. The Chinese government has a very different figure. There's a lot we don't know about this, and I think the isolation of the Uyghur people makes it much more difficult for us to find out.
Andre?
My perspective on this would be that it's very much in the framing of the story. And even though I, being an outsider in this panel, I appreciate very much the right to speak to your audience, to the American audience. And I know from experience that it's a big audience. I get reaction from people all the time. I kind of sympathize with the attitude of that lady who called. I think I know where she's coming from. Again, her point was bombing Iraq and killing hundreds of people in Iraq was okay, even though it was a mistake, and the current president believes it was a mistake, but the previous president believed it was necessary, so it's okay. America was doing it for better purposes, and it's a story framed like this. It's not okay for the Chinese to try to impose peace and quiet in their own country, as she puts it, because it's the way American press looks at it. The American press looks at it. I would point out that Chinese have a trillion plus people. In a few short, very short decades, the Chinese government, the communist Chinese government, has almost eradicated hunger in that trillion people, has almost eradicated the most dangerous disease among that people. They have done a lot of, they have had a lot of success. It's not a story. For the American press. I agree with the lady that when we try to look at those things, and I think the current crisis will lead to this. This is the biggest outcome of the crisis. You will have to respect other people and other people's way of life.
Let's turn to Ted in San Antonio, Texas. Thanks for calling us. You're on the air. Ted? In San Antonio? No? Okay. Let's turn to Babette in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You're on the air. Thanks for calling us.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about the border between Pakistan because that border is, they say, continually it is impossible to patrol or stop people from going across. And I might add that I'm an environmentalist, so what I'm proposing would not fit my environmentalism, but it's really a critical part of getting Afghanistan free of Taliban. And that, to me, is why don't they denude the forest so that something from the air could patrol, some of these little drone planes, and also could blow up the passes. And we blow up the mountaintops in West Virginia to get at coal. We surely could blow up the passes to making them impassable.
Thank you very much. You've been there, Farah. Try to give Babette an answer.
Well, she's right that border is a big problem. People, probably 40,000 people cross that border. There's no way to patrol it. There's 2,700 Afghan border guards patrolling that border, and they've only been in existence for like 3 years. And a lot of the border commanders are themselves involved in illegal activity, drug trafficking. So it's a huge problem. But I don't know if she's seen pictures out there. There are not a whole lot of trees.
Trees, no. It's really the mountainous terrain that's rather than the tree cover as was
right.
The problem in Vietnam.
Right, yeah. Right. So it is going to be one of the U.S. And Pakistan and Afghanistan, one of their biggest problems. They're looking at doing biometrics, at taking pictures of people's eyes. I mean, they're thinking of all kinds of things. But right now, you've just got a huge uncontrolled border. I think they're doing better, but they're really far from being able to control the people that go across, and including nomadic people. There are people who have families on both sides, and there's just no way to stop them from walking across.
Although there has been some success with the use of these drone aircraft in terms of attacking guerrilla camps and training sites?
Sure. Well, the drones go into Pakistan and they attack compounds. So I think that that's a separate issue. I mean, basically, the U.S. military, aside from the drones, has to stop at the Pakistani border. And that's one of the reasons there's been a sanctuary in Pakistan.
But one of the reasons they use the drones is they can cross the border.
Exactly, exactly. And then you also have the Pakistani military, which is now doing these aggressive operations in SWAT and other places. So we'll have to see how that pans out.
But they, too, have had a questionable history in terms of their, particularly the Pakistani Secret
Absolutely,
Service.
Absolutely. But the color's right in that. I don't think there's any other border like that in the world except maybe between Lebanon and Syria. It's just incredible.
Before we close this hour, very important news in another part of the world, in Latin America. Honduran president deposed by a military coup, attempts by to mediate, get him back into office. But it's complicated because the Honduran president, part of the complaint was that he was being undemocratic, but he was the democratically elected president. Poses a very thorny set of issues.
It's a very complicated story. Steve, I've actually been following it really closely because, just for personal reasons, Honduras was the first foreign country I ever visited as a college kid back in 1970, and I've sort of paid attention to Honduras. It's a very poor country, very weak democratic government institutions, and we have seen that come out right now. I mean, you're right. Mel Zelaya, the president, carried out what the other Hondurans regarded were illegal actions, and the other players in the Honduran system responded with illegal actions of their own. So we've got illegality, unconstitutionality on both sides. The United States has waded into this. I think that from the Obama administration's perspective, this is not just about Honduras. It's about it's about building democratic institutions across Latin America. It also has to do with dealing with Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Chavez championed Zelaya's return to power, even provided the plane that flew Zelaya back. And I think the Obama administration looked at this as an effort by Chavez to sort of assert his authority. And I think quite smartly, the Obama administration sort of took the ball away from Chavez. Now the United States is in charge of the mediation. The United States got Oscar Arias, the Nobel Prize-winning president of Costa Rica, to be the mediator. And what this has done, it has basically sidelined Hugo Chavez. And so I think the important thing here is you have to look at this in a broader regional perspective.
But part of what it does point up is that the word democracy, used frequently by the Bush administration and by this administration as a goal, can be very complicated because people who are democratically elected, quote unquote, but then abuse the democratic system, it's not as simple as saying he's the democratic elected president, therefore he should be restored.
He's the democratic elected president, but the Supreme Court in Honduras has authority as well, and as well as the Honduran Congress. So you've got, you know, you've got different branches of government. That's what a democracy is about.
Farah?
Well, you just mentioned the Bush administration's, and I just can't help but be struck by their response to the coup against Aristide. And I was there when Colin Powell said, we're not going to let a democratically elected president in this hemisphere get, you know, run out of town by a bunch of ragtag, mutineers. And then he said that on a Friday. And on a Monday, he said, okay, we're providing a plane to fly Aristide out of, to South Africa. And he, you know, they did not really make a big effort during that coup to restore Aristide. This administration is really involving the OAS and trying not to set a precedent where it's okay for a democratically elected leader to just be sent packing.
And actually, President Obama made an example of this case, of Honduras case in Moscow. When he was speaking in the New Economic School, he said, here you have a guy who was very critical of us, but still we support him because he was duly elected.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to a couple of more callers. And Jose from Grand Rapids, Michigan, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I just want to expand a little bit. It is a complicated situation in Honduras, but the situation here is that the president has to face in the future for Latin American relations, which side is the United States going to balance with? The new democratic left represented by Brazil, Chile, and other countries alike, or the neo-Stalinist, hardline socialist, an anachronic side represented by Cuba and Chavez. That is what is at stake here. Perhaps the handling, the tactical handling of the removal of Zelaya is questionable and unfortunate, but Honduras did act based on all the parameters of its constitution, and that is what needs to be balanced out here, because it has become now a geopolitical situation more than just local. The reputation of the OAS has been shot to pieces, and so as contrast to ALBA, manipulated by Chavez, and so from now on, for the next few years, the president is going to have to seek a balance and see what side he's going to side on with.
Thank you very much, Jose. Tom?
Well, I think that Jose is right. I think that the Obama administration has approached this very much with those objectives in mind. And it's, look at the picture on the front page of the Financial Times this morning. President Lula of Brazil has just given Barack Obama a football shirt signed by soccer shirt signed by the entire Brazilian soccer team. President Obama, the United States is actually on very good terms with what Jose calls the new democratic left of Latin America, Brazil and Chile, and has gone out of its way, I think, not to inflame any further relations with Chavez. And so I think that it goes to what we said before, that they are approaching this crisis in Honduras very much with an eye on their broader regional relations.
Of course, you can fit all the Brazilian names, since the soccer players only have one name, so you can fit them all. what about that? You've written a book about Cuba. The caller mentioned Cuba as well. How does that play into this Obama strategy?
Well, it's like what Andre was saying before. I mean, President Obama is just a new personality on the international stage, and it's really changed everything. You know, the population of Cuba is now majority, about 60% Afro-Cuban. So you've got an African-American president in Washington who was born after. He says, don't blame me for things that were done in Cuba before I was even born. Speaking about the possibility of a new beginning between the United States and Cuba, speaking to a largely Afro-Cuban population. I mean, this is an entirely new dynamic.
I just wanted to give you a little anecdote that I got from an oppositionist, a Russian opposition figure who took part in the meeting with President Obama in Moscow. He said that the leader of the Russian communists, Mr. Zyuganov, asked the American president when the embargo against Cuba would be lifted. And the response was, according to this person, that first the opposition in Cuba would not really appreciate if we jump out at this and lift the embargo. But he said that the issue will finally be resolved, ultimately be resolved.
Now, Farah, if you don't mind my saying, you too are representative of that, of the Obama syndrome, an African-American mother, an American father. What's your response to Tom's account of the relevance of Obama's ancestry to Cuba and Latin America?
Well, I've been to Cuba, but long before Obama was elected or even conceived of. I mean, I think Obama speaks to people. His story resonates with people all over the world, and everybody can take a little piece of it for themselves. I think that's what makes his presidency so exciting, not just for the United States, but for people around the world. And I think that I wouldn't be surprised if people in Cuba were reacting to him in that way.
That's Farah Stockman. She's the foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. Also with me this morning, Andrei Sitov, the Washington bureau chief for the Itar-Tass News Agency. Tom Gelton from NPR, whose book that we just mentioned about Cuba is called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the Biography of a Cause, coming out in paperback soon, right, Tom?
Thank you, Steve, indeed.
I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thanks for spending your Friday morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.